Greetings and Hulluvian protentations, my retrotastically Frigellian listeners. And welcome to this August 2018 Science News Update. I'm your host for this micronically Brobdingnagian science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. Okay, I don't know what the weather has been like this month where you are, but it has been horrendous in New Jersey, USA, and I think we have broken the record quite easily for more days over 90 degrees Fahrenheit. I know you Arizonans are laughing at our wimpiness, but throw in humidity of over 70% most of the time, and it has felt like the inside of an armpit for the last month here. If you're not a big believer in global warming, then the last month will make you one. I was 400 miles north of home in Montreal at the end of July at a plant biology conference, and I was amazed that it was no cooler up there than it was farther south. I have to say that I'm getting worried. It didn't help that half the symposia that I heard up in Montreal had to do with how plant biologists will need to alter crop genetics in the future to better deal with world climate change. It's a problem. So let's get on with tonight's rambling entertainment. Where shall we go from here? Let's start off with idiots in science. Yes, it is not quite the idiot scientist of the month, but it is sort of in the same neighborhood, kind of almost. So I've mentioned previously that I have a 3D printer, which I've used to print useful things around the house, like sink stoppers, a new handle for my snow shovel. And I've also printed some sort of silly stuff, like a full-size replica of Han Solo's DL-44 blaster. I have that on display in my office at work. It took me a month to put it all together and paint it and make it pretty much look like Han's gun. It's a model. No, it doesn't fire or have any components to fire a bullet. Now, if you're not from the U.S., there has been a major controversy here over the last several months of whether or not it should be legal to make plans for actual firing 3D printed guns available on the internet. The topic of DIY firearms has exploded into the mainstream recently after the Trump administration reached a settlement to allow crypto anarchist and Texan Cody Wilson to upload 3D firearm blueprints online. The court decision received an immense amount of pushback by politicians and gun control advocates, and a handful of states have filed lawsuits to keep the 3D printable gun blueprints off the internet. I spoke to a friend who is a policeman, and I asked him what he thought, and he was not worried. He said that anything printed would A, only fire one bullet at a time like a musket, and B, probably blow up in the hands of anyone stupid enough to make one. I suspect he's probably right in both instances. At any rate, he said plastic guns were not high on his agenda. We had a picnic last week at my home, and whenever anyone saw anything in my house 3D printed, they would immediately ask if I'd printed a 3D gun yet. Partly in jest, and partly seriously, I think. I suppose that the peril mentality is starting to set in. I suspect in years to come it will only get worse as 3D printers are able to print in multiple materials and make structures with greater and greater detail. It isn't going to be long before actual guns will be printable, a la the recent Lost in Space reboot or J.J. Abrams' horror SF movie, The Cloverfield Paradox. Both of those had actual 3D printed guns. And some futurists are suggesting that 3D printers in 100 years will be able to put together structures atom by atom and literally make just about anything. At any rate, back to guns and idiots. Australia has embarrassed itself with the following story. A pop culture fan and cosplay enthusiast from Sydney, Australia, is facing a possible jail sentence for producing 3D printed replica guns. A few months ago, 28-year-old hobbyist Sai Sen Sun was arrested for advertising an imitation weapon for $1 million on Facebook. Sun pleaded guilty to a handful of charges, including possession of 3D printable gun blueprints, manufacturing a pistol without a proper permit, and also possession of an unauthorized pistol. However, he claims that he only produced the replica firearms to use them as cosplay props. Sun said at his sentencing hearing, quote, "With 2020 hindsight, I just realized how silly, idiotic, stupid, and naive my actions were. I could not even begin to contemplate that a hobby would land me in such strife," unquote. Now, despite the nasty charges, Sun only made replicas, and none of them would shoot. Guns he made included a P-90 submachine gun from the Stargate TV show and a MA-5C rifle from the video game Halo. Although he admitted being aware that his cosplay weapons were possibly illegal to produce, he rationalized his actions by the fact that the weapons were incapable of firing a projectile. Which seems perfectly reasonable to me. I would be pretty damned upset if the police came and arrested me for making a copy of Han Solo's blaster with a solid plastic barrel. As for the $1 million asking price of his replicas on Facebook, Sun states he never expected to sell the props for such a high cost. He just wanted someone to acknowledge his work. Yeah, right. Well, he got acknowledgement. Not the kind that he wanted, though. Now he's gained recognition for being the first person in New South Wales, and as far as I know, the first person in the world to ever be charged with possessing blueprints to manufacture non-functioning firearms. The prosecutor for the case, Stephen Mackin, said that Sun's crimes are serious because the guns could still be used in a serious crime, even though they were fake. Really? Come on, seriously? So that means if you carve a replica gun out of a bar of soap in Australia and you paint it black, it will be illegal because it could be used in a crime? Because it looks like a gun? Has the world gone completely insane? So here is the serious question. At what point does a 3D printed replica go beyond cosplay and become dangerous, as that Australian prosecutor said? Okay, yeah, Sun made a stupid decision by publicizing his 3D creations on Facebook and saying they were for sale, but does this poor schmuck deserve jail time for manufacturing and attempting to sell 3D printed guns that look realistic but aren't actually lethal in any way? Okay, fine. Fine, Australia, yes, there's no denying that a weapon doesn't need to be functional to be used in a crime. A criminal with bad intentions could easily use a realistic-looking gun replica to inspire fear in his victims. But what does that mean for a cosplay enthusiast whose favorite character is known for packing heat? Does this mean that going to an SF convention in Sydney, you would be a complete idiot to be wearing that DL-44 blaster because you'd be thrown in jail? I've read that Australia has become one of the most proactive countries when it comes to creating laws that criminalize 3D printed guns and CAD models. At least, at the moment, they go way, way farther than the US has yet to go with their anti-3D gun laws. But frankly, I believe that the case against Sun is taking the 3D printed gun frenzy a step too far. I don't think that a cosplay enthusiast should be punished for his realistic-looking 3D printed prop guns. Now, you could argue that my rant is science or not, but I think that because many of you are cosplayers and many more make replicas like my DL-44, you may find the story quite applicable to your lives. Okay, let me get off the soapbox. Let's go into an entirely different direction with the first story of the evening. Let's go to Mars. We have two major stories on the Red Planet this evening, and they've both come out in the last month. The first story has to do with the discovery of a massive Martian lake on the surface, something that many believed was not likely or possible. A Mars orbiter has detected a wide lake of liquid water hidden below the planet's southern ice sheets. There have been much debated hints of tiny, ephemeral amounts of water on Mars before, but if confirmed, this lake actually marks the first discovery of a long-lasting cache of liquid. Dr. Roberto Orese of the National Institute of Astrophysics in Bologna, Italy, and his colleagues reported on July 25th in Science that the lake is about 20 kilometers across, but the water is buried beneath about a kilometer and a half of solid ice. Orosei spotted the lake by combining more than 3 years of observations from the European Space Agency's orbiting Mars Express spacecraft. The craft's MARSIS instrument, which stands for Mars Advanced Radar for Subsurface and Ionosphere Sounding, aimed radar waves at the planet to probe beneath its surface. Repeated passes by this ice-penetrating radar beamed down from the Mars Express orbiter revealed a hidden lake on Mars. As those waves passed through the ice, they bounced off different materials embedded in the glaciers. The brightness of the reflection tells the scientists about the material doing the reflecting. Liquid water makes a brighter echo than either ice or rock. Combining 29 radar observations taken between 2012 and 2015, the MARSIS revealed a bright spot in the ice layers near Mars's south pole, surrounded by much less reflective areas. Orosei considered other explanations for the bright spot, such as radar bouncing off a layer of carbon dioxide ice at the top of the sheet, but he decided that those options either wouldn't produce the same radar signal or were too contrived to be physically likely. And that left, of course, one option, a lake of liquid water. Orosei says, quote, "On Earth, nobody would have been surprised to conclude that this is water, but to demonstrate the same on Mars was much more complicated," unquote. Orosei's data suggests that the lake is probably not pure water. Temperatures at the bottom of the ice sheet are around minus 68 degrees Celsius, and pure water would freeze there, even under the pressure of so much ice sitting on top of it. But a lot of salt dissolved in the water would lower the freezing point. Salts like sodium and magnesium and calcium, which have been found elsewhere on Mars, they may be helping to keep this lake as being liquid. Orosei says that this is a big find in more than one way. Quote, "Though the newly discovered lake's depth is unclear, its volume still dwarfs any previous signs of liquid water on Mars. The lake has to be at least 10 centimeters deep for MARSIS to have noticed it. That means it could contain at least 10 billion liters of liquid water," unquote. So could there be any Martian life in that lake? Could there be some sort of bacteria, Martian bugs alive in there? Well, there are two problems with life in that puddle. Problem one is the temperature. And the temperature for cutoff for most terrestrial life is about minus 40 degrees Celsius. And that's pretty darn cold. We're talking even colder here. I mean, that Martian ice sheet is about minus 68 degrees Celsius, as I said. Very cold, colder than any environment on Earth, where any biologists believe life could either metabolize or replicate. And the second problem is the salt. Yeah, there's probably lots of salt in that lake. It ensures that the water stays liquid at that low temperature, but you need to have a disgustingly high level of salt in there. Mind you, we do have bacteria on Earth, they're called halophiles, that can survive under extreme salt conditions. But the high levels of salt combined with the cold, I'm not sure that any organism can evolve to that state. I mean, you're talking about extreme extremophiles. An extremophile is an organism that lives in extreme conditions. You're talking about two extreme conditions here, and I'm not sure what could survive under those conditions. I guess we're just going to have to wait to find out about life until a new probe is set up just to visit that Martian lake. The hard part with that is going to be that if anything is alive down there, it will be under meters of ice. That means drilling will have to occur in the ice to get down there, and that will bring up all sorts of problems on its own. So we have a second Martian story then. Well, some scientists are now speculating that it may be literally impossible to terraform Mars. Why? It's not quite so easy to explain. I mean, terraforming on Mars has been a dream that has pervaded SF for years. The idea has always been thought to be doable and pretty straightforward, but apparently it's now thought to be kind of neither. The consistent idea has been to make Mars more like Earth by raising both its temperature and pressure by adding an atmosphere made of greenhouse gases. We know that greenhouse gases trap heat, and yes, those are ironically the same ones that are making our summers so unbearable. The only ones present on Mars in any significant amounts are carbon dioxide and water vapor, and both of those are pretty much frozen at the moment. Most planetary scientists agree that if enough carbon dioxide were released into the atmosphere, we could warm up Mars in about 100 years once we start. Easy peasy, right? No. The problem is the amount of CO2 that actually is present on Mars. Doctors Bruce Jakowski at the University of Colorado and Christopher Edwards at Northern Arizona University reported in Nature Astronomy last month that there is simply not enough carbon dioxide that can be found on Mars to have any greenhouse gas effect. They used results from several spacecraft to build an inventory of all the carbon dioxide on Mars to figure out whether, if we moved all of it from the ground into the atmosphere, we could create high enough temperatures and pressures for life. Jakowski says, quote, "Right now, Mars has an atmospheric pressure of about 6 millibars, which is tiny compared to the 1 bar at sea level on Earth. We would need something like 1 million ice cubes of carbon dioxide ice, which are 1,000 kilometers across, in order to get to 1 bar. At 1 bar, the temperature would be just over 0 degrees Celsius, allowing liquid water and thus life on the surface. The atmosphere wouldn't be breathable, but humans could get by with breathing masks, not full spacesuits, and plants could grow freely, slowly building up oxygen over the course of centuries," unquote. However, Jakowski and Edwards found there's probably only enough carbon dioxide in the polar ice caps of Mars and dust and rocks to raise the pressure to about 20 millibars at most. So we can't terraform Mars with existing technology because there simply isn't enough carbon dioxide there. Jakowski is quick to point out that it's not as bad as all that. Quote, "It's not that terraforming itself isn't possible, it's just it's not easy as some people are currently saying. We can't just explode a few nukes over the ice caps," unquote. Why explode nukes over those precious ice caps that I spoke about in the last story? Well, because there may be hidden reservoirs of carbon deep under the surface that could make the job easier. Some people suggest the easiest way to get at hidden CO2 under the surface is with big bombs, but no one has any idea if those hidden reservoirs even exist. Jakowski and Edwards say they don't. Jakowski says that without the CO2, we have to come up with other ideas for warming Mars. He says that without enough carbon dioxide, we would have to warm up Mars some other way, perhaps by making chlorofluorocarbons or bombarding the planet with comets or asteroids, which does not sound that easy. And it still may not be enough to truly make Mars a home for humans. For that, we need nitrogen, and we're not sure how much nitrogen Mars has. Jakowski finishes with, quote, "If there's not enough carbon, terraforming will take thousands of years or more, but it's still possible. If there's not enough nitrogen, you are in much bigger trouble. You need Star Trek levels of technology to get that. Warp drives, tractor beams. You will need to pull nitrogen from the atmosphere of Jupiter and actually bring it to Mars. And that is going to be quite a challenge," unquote. Okay, next story. The next story is about as far from Mars as you can possibly get. Yes, it's about beef jerky. Now, I love me some beef jerky. It's convenient on hikes or long car drives or when you simply don't have time to get lunch at work. I have never thought that eating beef jerky could drive you insane, though. Dr. Robert Yolkin of Johns Hopkins reported last month in the Journal of Molecular Psychiatry that eating jerky may cause psychiatric disorders. The article is entitled, "Nitrated Meat Products Are Associated with Mania in Humans and Altered Behavior and Brain Gene Expression in Rats." Yolkin studied the dietary habit of more than 1,000 people with and without psychiatric disorders, and he found a link between eating nitrated cured meats, such as beef jerky and meat sticks, and episodes of mania, a serious psychological disorder that is one of the defining characteristics of bipolar disorder. The work showed that people who were hospitalized for an episode of mania were more than 3 times more likely to have eaten nitrate-cured meats than those without a history of a serious psychiatric disorder. Yolkin says, quote, "We looked at a number of different dietary exposures, and cured meat stood out. It wasn't just that people with mania have an abnormal diet." Further experiments showed that healthy rats fed a diet containing nitrate-cured meats or added nitrates triggered mania-like hyperactivity within just a few weeks. The researchers suggest that their results add weight to evidence associating dietary factors with the risk of neuropsychiatric disorders like bipolar disorder. Yolkin's team collected demographic, health, and dietary data for over 1,100 individuals with and without psychiatric disorders. The main inclusion criteria for participants with mania was current admission to hospital for symptoms of mania or hypomania. Patients with mania had been diagnosed with different forms of bipolar disorder and schizoaffective disorder. After the human studies, Yolkin decided to look at the effect more closely by feeding nitrate-cured meats to rats. And within a couple of weeks, the rats consuming the cured meat developed locomotor hyperactivity that actually mimicked the symptoms of human mania. These animals also demonstrated changes in hippocampal pathways in the brain that had been implicated in human bipolar disorder, as well as changes in their intestinal microbiota. In contrast, a high-dieted meat prepared without nitrate had no behavioral changes or hyperactivity changes or brain changes in the control rats. The authors finished their paper with, quote, "To our knowledge, this is the first study associating exposure to cured meat with a neuropsychiatric disorder. Although we feel further study is needed, individuals at risk for mania may consider limiting ingestion of added dietary nitrates," unquote. Okay, so that's bad news for you jerky lovers. Let's find some good news to even that out. There may be some news on the horizon about reversing some of the signs of aging, like wrinkles and hair loss. Dr. Keshav Singh of the University of Birmingham has now reported that both of those phenomena can be reversed in a mouse model. Last month, Singh's team reported his results in the journal Cell Death and Disease. Singh showed how a gene mutation that leads to mitochondrial dysfunction, and which is known to be linked with aging and age-related diseases in humans, causes animals to develop skin wrinkles and extensive hair loss within weeks. When the gene mutation is switched off and normal mitochondrial function returned, the same animals lose those wrinkles and regrow thick, normal coats of fur. Now, what is probably going through your heads with those statements is, big deal, how am I going to turn genes on and off in my mitochondria? And to this, Singh responds, quote, "To our knowledge, this observation is unprecedented. This mouse model should provide an unprecedented opportunity for the development of preventive and therapeutic drug development strategies to augment the mitochondrial functions for the treatment of aging-associated skin and hair pathology and other human diseases in which mitochondrial dysfunction plays a significant role," unquote. Mitochondrial DNA depletion and mitochondrial dysfunction is associated with, well, lots of diseases, and most of those are caused by dysfunctional mitochondrial oxidative phosphorylation, the process that generates ATP, the energy molecule that just about every cell uses for energy. A gradual decline in mitochondrial function has also been linked with aging and is known to drive age-related diseases. Studies have, for example, shown how increased mitochondrial DNA mutations lead to signs of premature aging in mice. To investigate more closely how mitochondrial depletion and mitochondrial dysfunction might play a role in aging, the team developed the mitochondrial DNA depleter mouse model, in which a key nuclear mitochondrial gene is mutated by adding the antibiotic doxycycline to food or drinking water. The gene mutation effectively leads to mitochondrial depletion, including reducing mitochondrial DNA content, reducing mitochondrial gene expression, and reducing oxidative phosphorylation activity. These mitochondrial DNA depleter mice develop normally until they're about 8 weeks of age, and at that point, the researchers start to administer the doxycycline, which starts to affect the mitochondria. Within 4 weeks, you start to get mitochondrial DNA depletion, and the animals start to develop gray, thinning hair and hair loss, and abnormal sebaceous glands. The mitochondrial depleter mice all developed thickened, wrinkled skin, and the wrinkles were more prominent in female mice than in male mice, in addition to slowed movements and lethargy that was reminiscent of phenotypic changes that would be expected to occur naturally as the mice aged. What's interesting is when the antibiotic treatment that turned the genes on or shut them off was withdrawn from the mice and their DNA was restored, the wrinkled, hairless animals gradually underwent rejuvenation. Within a month of stopping the antibiotic treatment, their skin wrinkles disappeared, their skin structure, including the hair follicles and the sebaceous glands, normalized, and they were free of inflammatory cells, and their hair grew back. Singh says that finding that mitochondria are regulators of skin aging and hair loss was unexpected. He finishes the paper with, quote, "This mouse model should provide an unexpected opportunity for the development of preventative and therapeutic drug development strategies to augment the mitochondrial functions for the treatment of age-associated skin and hair pathology and other human diseases in which mitochondrial dysfunction plays a significant role," unquote. So here's the last story of the night. Does caffeine in your coffee or tea change your perceptions of reality? Well, yeah, it turns out, but only in a rather minor way. And as an academic who drinks way too much coffee, I find this story particularly interesting. Dr. Yizhen Chu of Cornell University just published a paper this month in the Journal of Food Science that suggests that how you perceive sweetness changes with caffeine exposure. I guess that lots of you drink coffee or tea in the morning just to ensure you're wakeful for the first few hours of the day. The caffeine boosts alertness because it blocks the adenosine receptor in your brain, which promotes sleepiness. Chu says, quote, "The inspiration for this study came from previous research, which found that sweet taste could be enhanced through adenosine receptors in the taste buds. We decided to investigate whether caffeine also altered the perception of sweetness in humans," unquote. To test the effect of caffeine on taste, Chu recruited 107 healthy volunteers and offered them lightly sweetened, decaffeinated coffee. To half of the cups, they added 200 milligrams of caffeine to make it strong. To the other half of the cups, they added quinine to make the coffee equally bitter in taste to the caffeinated cups. Then they asked the participants to rate the sweetness of the coffee, along with solutions of varying tastes. Those who consumed caffeine rated the sweet solutions lower than the other group, although all the other tastes were perceived the same. Chu states, quote, "What surprised us was that the participants, given the caffeinated samples, still perceived the sweet solutions as less sweet even 15 to 20 minutes after they had finished their coffee. It occurred to us that if sweet-sensitive taste buds are tempered even a few minutes after drinking caffeine, it may lead some people to consume more sugar," unquote. Although the study volunteers did not know they received the caffeinated coffee, when the researchers asked them to rate their alertness, all the participants thought they were more alert, even when they drank the decaffeinated coffee. This implies a serious placebo effect confers alertness after drinking coffee. Chu concludes that, quote, "Based on our results, it seems that more people could try drinking decaffeinated coffee to help reduce their consumption of sweets, but still get that same level of alertness," unquote. That doesn't make much sense. I mean, if you think about it, the placebo effect only works if the participants are ignorant of which treatment they got. If the coffee drinker knows it's decaffeinated, it's not going to have the same effects, is it? Whatever. Chu is the MD. He knows better than the rest of us. Okay. Well, that's all for me for now. As always, take care. Cut down on that jerky intake. Don't expect to be living on green Mars very soon. Don't take that Replica 2 phaser pistol with you to the Continuum 15 SF Con in Melbourne next June. Cut down on that caffeine. Keep watching the skies. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.